Welcome to Herding Cats and Other Stories from the Genesis of the Neurodiversity Movement with hosts Oslin, Marenike, Kasiana, and Renee.
Hi, everyone. We're Foundations for Divergent Minds. I'm Oslin Latimer. I'm the executive director of FDM.
I'm Marenike Onawu. I'm the, a board member. I do research and advocacy and all that jazz.
I'm Kasiana Asasamas. I certainly have a title.
And I'm Renee Martin. I've managed to miss all the rest of these, and I believe my official title is Outreach Director.
I have superpowers, kind of, that may be translated, or that may be, you know, kind of dragged back to being autistic, but they are the worst superpowers. They're not really superpowers, okay?
Yeah.
It's just funny to say they are.
Can we also, while we're talking to y'all, can we like jump into the people who also say the, well, if we were in a world designed by autistic people, we would not be disabled. And I'm like, no, no, honey, yes, we still would, because like nobody would eat and the house would be a wreck. And like, that's not going to fix like the, okay, so the fluorescent lights would be gone, like hallelujah, and 100% of things would be able to be done online. Great. But, like, that is not going to mean anybody is going to be cooking and the bills are going to get paid. That does not help.
Yeah, all the utilities will be disconnected, yeah.
Also, which autistic people? Because, like, conflicting access needs, hello?
That's right? True.
Yeah. That too, but like I sit there every time I hear people going, well, social model of disability, and I'm like, that's not what that means.
I am trying to understand what words they're reading and how they're reading it, because I'm like, that's not what we're saying. Like, they're still
they're conflating the strong social model, you know, as the social model instead of being a model, you know, because right. I think it's quite clear that we know that, you know, it is a disability. You know what I mean? There are, there are advantages, there are disadvantages, there are strengths, there are weaknesses. You know, that's just the way that it is, like any other disability. But I think that people, it's important to look at our environment, you know, like we were talking about mm-hmm. in the other podcasts, you know, about the importance of universal design and, you know, accessibility. All of those things are great, but that doesn't change that addresses some of an issue. It doesn't change the reality.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so like that I don't get dizzy no matter how hard I try is never going to be useful in any circumstance. And that is my so-called superpower.
I mean, I would love to be closer to your side of that so I could go on the spinny things, because they do look like fun, but then I get on them and then they're not fun.
I would just like to not get dizzy standing up.
That's my big flex, is I don't get dizzy standing up or doing anything else. Like, you know, we don't have superpowers. Also, that is my, when people want to call us differently abled, that is my different ability, is I don't get dizzy. Yes, I am differently abled, but also I am disabled. So just accept it and move on with your life, please.
Right, but if there's a flashy light within 300 yards, you're having a seizure. Like, you're still disabled. Like,
I'm still disabled. It's fine. It's not a dirty word. I know a lot of dirty words. Disabled is not one of them.
Right? It'd be nice if people would just acknowledge that.
I connoisseur of dirty words, and disabled does not make the list.
It feels like we're having the same conversations that we had over a decade ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we are. You know, we actually are.
Literally, we are. Hey, here's a semi-new one, but it's related to Aspie supremacy. ADHD. What?
Please go for like a fuller there, because.
All right, so I'm going to upset people, maybe, and that's fine. I can live with that. ADHD is, for those who, if the three people listening who don't know, is the whole thing where people have ADHD and are autistic at the same time, which, okay, same. You know what? A lot of people have ADHD and are autistic at the same time.
Except
and
me.
There's a tip for Oswin. And, like, okay. At first, I actually was like, all right, a label for that neurotype is like, fine, I guess. You do you. I'm not going to use it, but go off. But there's like a lot going on around it where people are acting like it's a very specific neurotype. And I am unconvinced that's a thing. And it is very much, and the discourse is very much overlapping with ASPE supremacy. And I dislike that. Like, I strongly dislike that. I am not getting in your tent. No. Even though I belong in your tent, maybe I'm not going camping with you. I'm going camping with other people. Like, I don't understand. I don't know. Maybe I'm just old and don't understand. But I think a lot of
it is. No, it's not that you're... It's not. You're right. And so I think the problem is that people are so quick to want to... I don't think we spend enough time looking at what has come before us in general, in anything, in social movements, in health, and whatever, in fashion. Because I'm going to just be honest, because, you know, my experience as someone who has ADHD and you know, autism, my experience is that of the quote unquote ADHD. And so I kind of conflated a lot of the things that they're talking about. Well, yeah, of course, of course, of course. But then, you know, it's interesting when I look at my son, who is the one autistic person in the house who does not have ADHD. There is a difference, but it's the overlap. You know, it's kind of like we talk about intersectionality. Hmm. It doesn't mean we need to have a million different slivers of things. Like it's a spectrum. There's, you know what I mean? Like, and I feel like people are, you know, so, you know, things coexist, you know, like what they're doing is the autistic version, the flip side of the profound autism, where let's take everything that, you know, let's take, you know, a person who is, you know, doesn't speak, you know, maybe has higher support needs, maybe primarily non-speaking or an AAC user, and or has intellectual disability, and or this, and or that, and let's make this, let's carve out this category. That's what they're doing. When these things can exist together, these things can exist apart, they can exist with other like pieces there. And that's what I think that people aren't getting. And I think that it's just, it's a waste of time. And I'm sure it makes people feel better to understand or connect or whatever with other people. But where is it getting us as a community? Like, what's the practical application of it?
What I think about with it is that I think the misunderstanding what neurotype means, I think they're misunderstanding what neurotype means, because everyone's neurotype is individual, because it's not just like your innate things, but like what you've experienced in your culture and your community and the society you live in, and all these things creates your neurotype, which is why some people have innate neurotypes that develop over time and that are divergent from the norm. And then there are other people that over time grow to have a different neurotype than the norm because of the experiences that they've had. So like acting like ADHD is a specific neurotype kind of misunderstands what a neurotype is altogether and doesn't really even tell you a whole lot about that person's support needs. It goes back to high and low functioning. It goes back to these delineations because people want to have a different way of having their things addressed than what doesn't work for any of us.
For me, I have been known to use the ADHD shorthand because for me, it is really just was just an attempt to be a shorthand to not have to type everything out. But I think a lot of people are misunderstanding, like, to me, it's like a Venn diagram that failed. You know, that people are seeing the autism and the ADHD and then the overlap, and they're only seeing that little middle section, and they're not seeing that the Venn diagram has lots of circles. And
exactly.
So they're only seeing that tiny little sliver, and they're calling themselves that, and they're not seeing all of the overlapping pieces of the Venn diagram and thinking that being in that little thing, you know, connects them to just who's in that, and they're missing all the rest of the important umbrella and circles.
That makes sense because because when it first came out, it just seemed like a really quick shorthand for the two. But then over time, what happened, I'm like, this is confusing to me because one, some of the things that are on the ADHD side that you're talking about, I know are an autistic thing for me. It just, it's a presentation of a different synthesis in my head.
One of the things that was confusing.
And it's like, I don't know why you're subdividing things this way and not like, and I thought this was like a really big, like, oh, now you can see you're part of this bigger whole and not this little sliver. So that makes a lot more sense. Thanks, Renee.
Right. Yeah, I think that they're just trying to see themselves in the Venn diagram. But we need to remind people, you know, that like, I know plenty of people who are also IDDD, who are also ADHD and autistic. Their Venn diagram is overlapping, and you need to remember that they count just as much for the. It's not just the people that you want to put in there. Everybody who falls into ADHD fits, or the label is meaningless. Like, you can't do that.
Oh, just like neurodivergent. That might actually be part of my problem.
I was just going to ask if Renee can talk to that, because she wasn't here for the other ones, and this is a different perspective that I think is important. This is why I like having our token white.
Yes.
But is that why neurodivergent have become what it has become? Is because they're trying to fit the Venn diagrams that they see into neurodivergent and not everything else?
I think it's possibly a combination of that. And I think it's also, problematic white person moment for a second here. Since the vast majority of diagnosed and now grown up people were white, we have a tendency as white people to need to be special for something. And so we're a lot of times appropriate labels that might not have been what they were intended to be, and then make them smaller so that we can be a little bit more special than we naturally are.
Oh my God.
That's a very,
I
love how you did that, because it's like, you're saying it in a way that's just, you know, like very matter of fact.
You're allowed to say that.
Yeah, but also it's such an autistic way to say it, because it's kind of like, look, hey, I'm going to explain what I think the rationale behind it is. It's, you know, because people get in their fifis, they get all emotional, get upset, and it's kind of like, yeah, and you're just explaining, it's not what the qualifier, it's just, this is what people are trying to do. It's like small talk. Like, I explained to my daughter when she just picks up the phone and I'm like, hey, you need to say hi or hello or something like that. She's like, but why? They called me. And so I'm answering, so they know I'm there. I was like, I know that's the case, but if you don't acknowledge them in some kind of way, they think it's rude. So even though they called you, and you answered, which is what they wanted, they expect some kind of vocalization. So, that's the purpose of it. And so this is the reason, whatever the thing is, it's the reason is trying to find connection, understanding, you know, naming things. It's about, people will go to a land that has a name and name it whatever they want to name it. Or they'll write an executive order naming something that's already named. It's kind of like the whole, phenomenon.
Right. Exactly. And as the world feels like it's getting, you know, browner, queerer, blacker, more diversified, you know, I can see people that are voting against their own best interests doing what it takes to make themselves still feel special. And it's going to take decolonizing your own brain to realize that maybe you shouldn't be doing that when you've had a brown queer person tell you that that is not what that means.
I just feel like maybe I need to just start doing that. I need to do a video of that in like December or January when I haven't seen the sun in like months. And those of you who are listening who are unaware, number one, I think I'm funny. Number two, I am biracial Asian, and I get passed as white approximately 4 months out of the year, and the other 8 people aren't quite sure. So January is the month.
There you go.
What I was thinking about was, okay, so this also then explains why neurodiversity affirming therapy changed into what it has become instead of what Joel intended it to be.
Mm.
Because he was saying he intended it to be a trauma-informed perspective, similar to how queer therapy is done, recognizing the trauma that occurs. But it has now been co-opted by other parts of therapy practices. And so they're still trying to do the same normative stuff, but in a more affirming strengths-based way that kind of tells people that your strengths are enough to hold you for the rest of your life, which is not true.
That's a combination of not true and completely useless.
Because like, we break down. That's just going to happen when you live in a world that expects something different of your brain and body than it's capable of.
Okay, how is strengths-based not secretly, like, not sneakily pathology?
Deficit.
Right? Yeah, deficit.
I mean, this
That's
has
not a
been
money.
my argument. In order for it to be a strength, you have to be pathologizing something that you're ignoring.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, you're saying the, it's like a compliment sandwich.
Yeah, compliment sandwiches. They're so confusing. Because there's all of this information that I thought was just like, okay, you're giving me perspective.
Did you like it or not? Did you like it or not? Help me out.
I don't know. And if you didn't like it, then I need to tell me what you didn't like about it so I can explain to you, oh, you're wrong, because I... Because usually when people are doing that, it's because they're trying to put white-centric social norms onto me. And I'm like, no,
mm-hmm.
We're not doing that right now. Because usually if I'm in the room, then you're asking for somebody that's disrupting the room that you're in. I don't end up in rooms by mistake. That's who invites me in just because I like play the part. Have I ever done that?
Oh my gosh. Sorry, now we're talking about compliment sandwiches.
Yeah,
that's my bad.
Like, compliment sandwiches always come when somebody is trying to get you to change your social norms.
Mm-hmm. They're like so manipulative.
They are.
What? They
absolutely are.
And like, I feel like strengths-based is similar, is also a pathology paradigm, and it's in a similar way. Like, okay, so this was good, but you still need to fix this and make it more like this. And I like your hair.
And honestly, okay. I think like strengths-based for like art therapy, art talk therapy, or play therapy, or like or anything that's going to be somatic, the strength space can be really good to help people like get past
mm-hmm.
like some really ingrained self-beliefs.
Yeah like I'm not saying it's necessarily bad, I'm just saying that it is not coming from,
it's still pathologizing. It's just trying to help people see outside of just the negative pathology. They can see the positive pathology and like, okay. And now that we've gotten there, what's the next step? Because now we got to get away from the pathology.
Well, it almost makes me think that there needs to be like an Alfie Cohen of autism type book read, you know, where he's like, you can't mm-hmm. praise your kids and you can't denigrate. You gotta, you know, you love them no matter what, because if you're overly praising your kids, if you're overly rewarding your kids, then people come to expect that, you know, and if they don't get it, then they think they failed, right? That's mm-hmm. how strength-based feels too. So maybe we just need the neutral, the, you know.
I like that.
Yeah. So yeah, like this.
Because you're looking at the, you know, the intention, it's like the intention versus impact thing.
You mean like our framework?
Yeah.
Exactly like our framework.
I don't think we've talked about it all in the, in this podcast.
Yeah. Oh, well, do we get to pivot to that? That's awesome.
Yes. Let's go ahead and do that.
Are we actually going to talk about what we're here for? It's a stunning,
And we didn't even plan that. That was like natural.
That's awesome. So I think that a lot of people think that the framework is meant to just be for like therapy, but it's not. It's just people recognize like what our innate traits are and then what we might need help with based off of the environment that we're in. And since all places that we are an environment, it changes. No matter what, like it's always changing. So we have to have like this map of like what your brain is doing to be able to respond to the environment. And so that's what the framework does. It subdivides it. It subdivides it first into sensory integration and then into executive functioning. And then from those two, we get into the cognitive processes, which are motor, skills and like communication skills and social skills. And I mean social skills in the literal sense and not the pejorative sense. And then emotional regulation. And because all of those layer in together, we get like a map to be able to help people navigate whatever environment they're in based off of how their sensory system works and how their executive functioning system works.
Love it. And recognizing that it's different, like every environment, you can't build one map.
No.
It's like you can't have a map of your house and expect it to work in Walmart. That is not going to work.
So you have to build it up for each environment. So that's going to be different for school or home or going to the store or participating in sports or going to art and doing art or whatever it is, that each environment is going to be so completely different because what you're there for is different and what that environment looks like is different and how your body responds to that environment is going to be different because all those things change.
I think that we're really unique in that we acknowledge sensory and motor very early in like the process. Because like people will now get, you know, people will acknowledge sensory issues and they will acknowledge like motor planning issues. But then when it comes to actually addressing things, people forget that they acknowledge them. It seems.
Well,
if that makes sense.
I yes, think it does. And I think the reason for that is that a lot of people think that sensory processing concerns are only when the big events happen or it shocks your system, instead of realizing, no, they're always happening. And then that impacts the integration, because if you get a lot of your body in space, not me, but most people, then you may need a lot of movement to be able to keep regulating. And that's going to be a constant thing, but it may only come out in the moments where it bursts out and you need to run out the door because everything is overstimulating because something else is also going on at the same time. And these things are always going on. And so if you're not supporting them always, then the integration of them is also really heavy for your brain. Because you're because it's getting too much of some things and not enough of other things, and so the integration, your brain is having to do that in real time, and it's like how your brain isn't going to be able to do that constantly in real time. So you have to think about it always as the baseline, because every environment is sensory.
I can listen to and do, you know, 2 hours of recording in my hobbit hole of an apartment with my weighted blanket that I could not possibly do anywhere that I did not control the lights.
Absolutely. I was going to say, you know, and this is one of the things that parents need to think about when they're like, I remember when one of my kids was younger, we discovered that the I can't for finding and putting on shoes, as silly as this sounds, was connected to whether or not I bought a shirt that had a tag attached to it or the stamped tag. And once we got rid of all the tags in the shirts, suddenly we could handle shoes in the day. But anything that had a tag made it so that that extra step was just one step. It was just enough to throw the whole thing.
That makes sense.
It does.
It makes
but
complete
it,
sense.
It, but it threw it does. But it threw the whole day until we figured it out.
It's like fork theory.
Right. Yeah. For sure.
Oh, can you explain fork theory? Because I think most people know spoon theory, but fork theory is awesome for us.
Okay. So, you know, spoon theory, which is you only have so many spoons, so much energy in a day. But have you heard of fork theory, where there's only so many inconvenient or uncomfortable things you can handle in a day at a time? So you need to, at some point, you need to remove a fork or just kind of dump all your everything over the floor. So, for example, it's a day, you are uncomfortable, you're sitting in a chair that's not very nice, you need to pee, you're hungry, the lights are too bright, and you can hear traffic. Okay, that's too many things going on. They are discomfortable. Discomfortable is, in fact, the word I mean. You can fix one of those things and maybe get back to regular. So, like, my go-to is always, oh, too many things are going on, I'm going to go pee, because that's usually easier to fix than being hungry. And I often don't have the spoons to fix being hungry until I am not so uncomfortable that I'm going to, you know, melt down if anything goes wrong. But yeah, I love fork theory. I also love spline theory. Are we familiar with spline theory?
I am not.
I remember spline. I am. You shared that with me ages ago.
Spline theory is my favorite, actually, because, okay, for those of us who cannot change plans in the middle after we set up to do spline theory, basically, I don't even know where the person got reticulating splines from. I think it's from the loading page of a video game.
It is.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. You get all set up to do a thing. You're all ready to do your tasks for the day, right? You have mentally set up the scaffolding. You maybe haven't even had to do any of the physical scaffolding. And then somebody says, hey, I know we were going to go to the store, but can we go get lunch first? And everything crashes down internally because you have to change everything. That is the feeling of having to re-reticulate your splines.
Oh, I love that one. That one is so perfect because it happens so often. Like, this is why I have this thing where when I've got two very good friends that I go and hang out pretty often with, and they're both ADHD. And so when I go into their space, my rule is I am not planning on anything. I am going to go with what you direct. And so whatever happens, happens. Mm-hmm.
I have a personal rule where if you change something on me last minute, I cannot solve the problem. You changed it on me, then you have to figure out what we're doing instead. You have to figure out every aspect of what we're doing instead because I can't. Mm-hmm. You tore down my splines. That. I can't build them back up in the amount of time we have. You are now the spline holder.
Yep. Yep.
There's also... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I do the same thing. I don't say it that way, but like, no, it's like I can't make any more decisions today.
Yeah, I started saying it that way because people were choosing to not understand that it wasn't a won't, it's a can't. So, like, no, you're the spline holder now. You brought this upon yourself.
There's another one that I always love that I'm struggling to find, but it was matchstick theory. One of the things that I loved about that one is, you know, the concept of a spoon and forks. If those are reusable. And when you're talking about energy and disability, that
shit is reusable. It's so fine. That is deep.
I use that match and I burn it. And you know what? It's gone and it might force my fingers, but I get to decide what I'm using my band matches on. You don't. Did I start the fire?
Yes. I don't use spoon theory on the daily. I actually use spell slots.
I love that one, too. Yeah,
because there are some things that are level one spell slots and there are some things that are level five spell slots. And I get a number of level one spell slots, right?
Okay. That's right. What are slots?
Spell, as in for magic, spell slots. So, okay, in games like D&D, you get a larger number of spell slots for lower level, easier magic. And then for your higher level, you get many fewer. So, like, there are some things that are a level one or level two spell slot. They're easy. I can do them. I can do a number of these things. I can take a shower. That's easy for me. I can make my bed. That's easy for me. I can feed the cats. That's easy for me. Then I'm doing laundry or going to the post office. These are, like, my level five, six spell slots. I can do one of these things. I cannot do both of these in a day. And now, can I feed the cats with my level five spell slot? Yes. Can I go to the post office with my level one spell slot? Absolutely not.
Right.
It is not going to happen. So that kind of allows for more on the differentiation between difficulty of tasks. And it's kind of the same as spoons, but it's also different because... spoons, you're counting spoons instead of number of tasks you can do in a day. And I'm kind of a number of tasks I can do in a day person, amount of energy in a day kind of person.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think I do it by that, but I think my functioning is just so variable that I don't have, like, because there are different things I can do to gain, I guess, a spell slot, but like, how much of a spell slot I gain back isn't clear until I've ended it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't tell anyone we're autistics using metaphors. We're not allowed.
I mean,
we're gonna take our cards away.
I would almost say that's sarcastic, but you obviously don't know that either.
I know. I don't know sarcasm. I'm autistic. And I'm definitely not funny. We have no sense of humor.
Never. No, we just don't think things that aren't funny need a laugh.
I know. That's my favorite bad research paper.
I don't know where that
is. All right, y'all know. Give a little context. You know, people may not know.
Okay,
so somebody did some research at one point about how they compared humor. So it was comparing laughter in autistic people and people with Down syndrome. And they did this by showing autistic kids and kids with Down syndrome allegedly funny videos in which it wasn't just like something funny, but it was like something embarrassing funny happened. And then watching the laughter. And I believe they also showed them something actually funny. Full disclosure, I don't think embarrassing funny is funny. I'm like, oh, secondhand. I'm uncomfortable when I watch that.
Yeah, exactly.
The kids with Down syndrome social laugh, in addition to sincere laugh, the autistic kids only sincere laugh. And okay, so things to know about laughter. People can tell if it's a sincere laugh or a social laugh, like a laughing to match everybody else laugh. People prefer real laughs. The conclusion of this study was, so we need to teach autistic kids to social laugh, to fake a laugh, and pretend something's funny, even though it's not.
It's good that they are being true to themselves, and since they don't think this is funny, they're not laughing. We need to teach them to be more fake. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like,
all that we need to teach unfunny things. What we just don't do unfunny things except laughter.
The part of it that like just plays me is that it's not even like people prefer or even enjoy a fake laugh.
But they're just accustomed to
kind
it.
Of laughing autistic people are doing is genuinely superior. And yes. So yeah, that's
so
my favorite
about the fact that maybe we as a society shouldn't think that it's you should socially laugh at someone being embarrassed or harmed. You know what I mean? But no, we have to get, you know, we need to be fixed, not them. And don't forget about the one, I know you talk about this one sometimes, where they were saying that there's something was wrong with us because of us being too altruistic, not wanting to do right. things that will. Yeah. So do you want to talk about that one too?
Yeah. Oh, you can talk about that one.
Okay, sure. So y'all correct me if I get this wrong. One of the, they did research and it determined that autistic people will not, typically in the study, would not do things that violated our ethics, even for personal gain, like, you know, found a bunch of money or something like that. So even if it was, so we would rather, even, you know, we would rather have less of something or do without than lie for gain. And so they found that was wrong. That's something that's wrong with us. We're not ambitious enough because the typical person is going to do what is in their own best interest as opposed to what is the ethical thing to do. So we were deficient because of that.
I mean, that goes along with the fact that research has thought that for years being unethical like that was like a human norm. It was only when they started studying other cultures that are not as colonized, that they found that there was more altruism and more acceptance of like basic human decency in other cultures. Uh-huh. And it's like, yeah, no, y'all have just been wrong about like what human nature is.
Like, y'all are just kind of bad at being people. And it wasn't there also a study where like autistic people would give the same answer, or to, I think it was an ethical conundrum, whether they were being observed or not, or is that the same one?
I think that's the same one.
No, I think that's a different one. I'm not sure, but either way, it still shows that they're like, you know, like pathologizing something that should be a good trait.
We're morally consistent, and somehow that's a problem.
Yes.
Like, although that
to tie that back to the ethical supremacy that we were talking about, we also have to remember that some people's ethics we don't agree with.
Yes, right. Yeah, some people's ethics we don't agree with, but that's not what. But at least we know they're morally consistent. So if they're saying it to our face, they're definitely acting on it behind their backs, and we can call them jerkwads. with impunity.
Yes. And that's why it's frightening for them to want to train us not to do that, because, you know what I mean?
They want to train us in deceit. Call a spade a shovel, please.
I definitely swore because I read Remy's thing that definitely had very many curse words.
Yeah.
As is the point of Remy's writing, it's pointless. Yes.
And a lot of my writing does too, but I'm capable of not.
Oh my goodness. I think we're winding down. It sounds like we're winding down.
I think
we are.
Probably, yeah. I think so.
So, is there anything else we need to talk about before we hang up?
Marnie Kay, do you have anything coming that you want to promote?
I'm not promoting my stuff until after it's done. I do want to share this, though. I wonder if, you know, although there's no, you know, source that's perfect, but I wonder if maybe we could close with kind of sharing a few places that might be helpful for people who want to kind of dig into, you know, kind of some information about, like, you know, the history, or kind of understand some key moments, you know, like, because we don't know, you know, everyone's grabbing a little bit of this on TikTok, a little bit of this on IG, a little bit of this wherever they found from whatever, and we don't know who they, you know, like we talked about in the first, you know, that some people have no idea who Mel Bags was, or they don't know who Anita Cameron is, or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, so I'm wondering if maybe that we could, even if there are things that we feel, you know, still could use some work, or maybe aren't as inclusive as they should be, if we could just kind of, you know, suggest a few resources for people to kind of do more, a little more digging themselves.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and suggest Autistic Archive. That's sites.google.com/view/autistic-archive/home, and that has timeline, it has books, it has people. Not everyone is on there, but it is a really good place to start, and it has other websites so you can find other things that came before and do some reading there.
Am I allowed to, you know, promote something I've been working on?
Yes,
totally.
Yeah, I I'm almost done, but by the time this is out, I will be on chaoscares.com. I'm building a symptom and doctor and medication and, like, everything, disability, all of the tracker thing that you need. And it'll even have, like, the ability to type in your doctor's office, and then it's going to have the buttons where you can click and go straight to your portal, or click and it'll dial the doctor for you on your phone.
Cool. I am doing no things.
I want to share, so if, you know, again, for anyone who knows about this, sorry, but I don't know what y'all know and don't know, so I'm going to share it, that there is an open access book that came out, when did this book come out? Was it 2016? I'm trying to remember when it was.
Even Chops one, because I think that was 2018.
Yeah. Maybe it's 2020. Yeah, sorry. It's was edited by Stephen Kapp, who's autistic, and it has, you know, primarily autistic authors, although there's a few people who are holistic in there. And it's called Autistic Community and the Neurodiversity Movement: Stories from the Frontline. And so it's, you know, there is a hard copy book, but the book is free. The entire book is available online, but there's also individual chapters. They're also free and available online. And so people you know, review those. And if they're interested in looking into that, just kind of list a couple of the names of a couple of chapters once I get to the right page. I think it's just helpful because it's thought, it talks about Jim Sinclair's Don't Mourn for Us. It talks about, like, the independent living movement and, you know, some of the, how, you know, it talks about autistics.org. So some of these things you'll also see in the Autistic Archive. It talks about some of the, you know, the different, like, the development of the Aspire Network, a lot of the work, you know, the self-advocacy work into what we talked about, you know, this transition between DSM-4 and 5. It talks about Autism Speaks. It talks about the first autism and race anthology, like protesting, the genocide clock, just a lot of different, some of the autism or autistic gatherings, like Autscape. So it's just, you know, it's a way for people to kind of just look into, you know, what things that have been important in our movement, because it's, you know, it's a fairly young movement, but it's 30 something years. I mean, it's like, it's not old, you know, and it's still growing.
And I also want to do one other thing, because it's not on the archive and it doesn't sound like it's going to be on there. Back in the, I want to say it was the late aughts, or maybe early 2010s. the Society for Disability Studies Journal did a whole journal on neurodiversity, and it has some of the earliest like academic writing on the movement. Let me, Disability Studies Quarterly, and you can look it up, DSQ Neurodiversity, and it should come up pretty, yeah, the first link does. And so you can go and look at that whole journal to see some early academic writing around the movement.
And to pull it out of academic stuff, because although, you know, I'm a nerd, I also realize that's not everybody's thing. I really love, I talked about Anita Cameron, who is, you know, been involved, who's autistic as well as blind, queer, you know, a number of things, Black, you know, et cetera. But is basically creating an initiative called We Were There Too. And so it's going to be like narrative, storytelling, imagery, things like that, highlighting. It's not solely autistic people, you know, it's like a lot of Black disabled activists in general. But of course, you know, being that Anita is multiply disabled, including autistic, there's some of that as well. But it talks about a lot of really cool things. And, you know, with, you know, so it's another project that's unfolding. It's actually being, it's funded by Borealis Philanthropy, and Autistic Women and Non-Binary Network is the fiscal partner to support the program. So that's another one. It kind of talks about why some of us are left out of the movement, why are we, you know, why our voices are not, you know, included. It shares the stories of different activists and, you know, some images and things like that. So it's worth checking out. The website is wewerethereto.org.
All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. I hope you enjoyed, and we will come back and do this all again later.
We're supposed to end with some kind of saying about how it's like herding cats when we get together or whatever. I can't remember how we're supposed to do it.
I don't want to do that.
I don't know, but I actually need to go herd my cats.
Okay. Oh, she liked that.
You got me this time. So I'll say goodbye for everybody. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Herding Cats. If you like what you hear, please like and subscribe. It really helps us grow our community with your help.